Hey, all you true crime fans, this is Mike Ferguson.
And this is Mike Morphin.
And we'd like to invite you to listen to our podcast, Criminology.
Launched in 2017, we've covered a variety of strange cases from murders to missing persons.
We dive into a variety of cases in both the U.S. and abroad.
Some of the cases are ones you may not have heard of, like the Pocatello babysitter murders or the canal murders.
Other cases we cover are some of the most historic in true crime, like the Tylenol murders and the Lindbergh kidnapping. We also dive into cases that are currently breaking thanks to DNA and forensic genealogy.
Sometimes you'll hear from people connected to the cases, like the interview we did with the brother-in-law of the Golden State Killer, Joseph DeAngelo.
There are close to 200 episodes of Criminology available to binge on right now, including full seasons covering the Zodiac Killer, the Golden State Killer, and Ted Bundy. And new episodes come out every Saturday night.
Subscribe to Criminology today, wherever you listen to your podcast.
We know you did this. We have evidence. She trusted you. But you had to do what you did. And look where it got you. And now you're going to jail!
Orange Park is a suburb of Jacksonville in Florida. It's a popular area for families to raise their children, away from the hustle and bustle of city life. The 19th of October 2009 started out as a quiet day for the local police department as they patrolled the well-kept neighborhoods. At around 4 p.m., however, a frantic woman flagged down a police officer and exclaimed that her daughter had gone missing. Summer Thompson was born in Columbia, South Carolina, on the 5th of April 2002, to parents Samuel and Dina Thompson. In addition to Summer, the couple had three other children, Sam, Abby, and Andrew. Sam was Summer's twin brother. Unfortunately, the shared love that Samuel and Dina had for their children wasn't enough to save the marriage, and the couple called it quits when Summer was a young girl. Samuel moved to Graham, in North Carolina, and Dina and the children set up home in Orange Park, Florida, which is a suburb of the sprawling city of Jacksonville. They lived in a heavily populated residential area, dotted with homes, apartment complexes, and condominiums. People here liked to keep their gardens well manicured, and it was a nice place to raise a family. The middle-class area suited the family well, in particular the children, who enjoyed playing outside. There was always an abundance of local children to play with, whether it be playing football or rollerblading. In the summer, the children enjoyed swimming in the neighbor's pool. Summer was very creative, and she loved to dance, play dress-up, draw, and colour. She really made friends in the neighbourhood and at school with ease. Other children were always drawn to Summer's sweet nature, and as her mother Dina said, she just wanted to be friends with everybody. This sweet nature extended to practically everybody, not just Summer's friends and family. As Pastor David Tarkington said, she was a community hugger, who even hugged the crossing guard on the way to school each morning. Summer was known for these hugs. Her father Samuel said that when you received a hug from Summer, you felt like there was no greater love in the world. Summer absolutely loved being a twin, and if somebody ever saw Summer outside, they just knew that Sam would be nearby. She also had a soft spot for animals, and if she saw a cat or dog in the street, she always made sure to stop and pet them. The 19th of October 2009 started out like any regular day for 7-year-old Summer. She got up that morning, got ready for school, eat her breakfast, and then walk with her siblings, 7-year-old Sam and 10-year-old Abby, the short distance to Grove Park Elementary School, where she was a second grader. This was routine for summer. Some mornings, Dina drove the children to and from school, but when she was working, the children were either taken by a family friend, or they needed to walk to school. It was only around a mile away. The family lived paycheck to paycheck, so Dina couldn't really be selective about her working hours, and she worked whatever hours were given to her. Dina surmised that it was safe. There was always a group of children walking together, and it was quite a short walk. Neighbours always looked out for the kids as well as they walked to and from school. The year beforehand, however, a social worker at Grove Park Elementary School had raised some concerns about the four siblings. This social worker told the Department of Children and Families that Summer and her siblings had gotten lost at least once while walking home. They claimed that the children were found in the woods with a stranger. The Department of Children and Families did investigate this claim from the social worker. Summer said that they had never gotten lost. Sam said that he had gotten lost once, but he provided no details. And as for Abby, she was never asked. It was unclear where the social worker had gotten her information from. The Department of Children and Families found that the claim had no basis. They also found that it was acceptable for the children to walk the 1 mile distance between the school and home. The case was closed without any findings of wrongdoing. Back to the 19th of October. The children got to school safe and well that morning. In between classes, Summer shared her excitement with her friends for Halloween, which was fast approaching. She had already picked out her costume and could barely contain her excitement for the annual trick-or-treating in the neighbourhood. That afternoon, the bell signalling home time rang. Summer collected up her belongings, stuffed them into her backpack, and met up with Sam and Abby to walk the short distance back home, like they did many weekdays. A friend of Summer also joined them, as she lived nearby and she wanted some company. It was around 2:45 p.m. and the group of children were walking along the sidewalk when Summer and her friend got into a squabble. Summer's sister told her to stop, which caused Summer to get upset and run off ahead of the group. As the group passed Gano Avenue, they saw Summer sitting beneath a palm tree. She had her hands covering her face, crying over what had just transpired. The group observed Summer for a couple of minutes and then continued on their route. Sam and Abby arrived home and waited for Summer to come in after them, but she never did. They informed Dina that Summer had broken off from the group, and Dina set off in search of her daughter, retracing the route that she would have taken, anticipating to see her chatting with some friends about the altercation she had just had. But there was no sign of Summer. At around 4 p.m, Dina flagged down a deputy to report her daughter missing. The afternoon had been a quiet one for the local police station, but by early evening, it was bedlam as they searched for the missing girl. The first point of action for the police was to try and retrace Summer's last known movements, in the hopes that they would find her, hopefully hiding out somewhere, to try and teach her sister a lesson. Unfortunately, however, there was no sign of Summer. Investigators on the case also considered whether Summer had stopped at a friend's home en route to her own home. But after making contact with all of Summer's friends, they discovered that this wasn't the case. Summer had truly gone missing, and time was of the essence. According to a couple of neighbours, they had seen Summer walking alone near West Gano Avenue and DeBarry Avenue. Over 100 detectives from Clay County converged outside Summer's home and spanned across the neighbourhood and further afield, looking for a clue that could lead them to Summer. She had no history of running away from home, which only further compounded the fear of her family. Something else that the family feared was that just a couple of days beforehand, three people had tried to lure a little girl into a car in the same neighbourhood. This was something that investigators did look into, but they declared that there was no connection between that case and the disappearance of Summer. The same day that Summer had vanished, a naked man had chased a girl from a Jacksonville High School bus drop-off. Thankfully, The girl managed to run home, but investigators wanted to see if there was somehow a link between the disturbing incident and Summer's disappearance. As it turned out, there wasn't. It was a sleepless night for Dina, who tossed and turned as she worried about where her daughter could have been. As soon as the sun rose, she was back out searching the streets. But once again, there was no sign of Summer. That morning, police issued an Amber Alert. Mum wasn't issued the day beforehand because Summer's disappearance wasn't witnessed by anybody, and there was no vehicle description, two details which are typically required to issue such an alert. As the Amber Alert was issued, investigators ramped up their search for Summer. There were 161 known sex offenders living in the area. And while that was something that Summer's parents didn't even want to consider, it was an angle that needed to be looked at. Investigators would visit each one of these sex offenders to aggressively question them regarding Summer's disappearance, but none of them could provide any insight, and it was ruled out early on that a local sex offender had taken Summer. However, they could not account for those who had absconded or those who may have been living in the area unregistered. Investigators also contacted Summer's father, who was living in North Carolina, but he was quickly ruled out as a suspect, as were all other family members. The search for Summer intensified. It had now been over 12 hours since she was last seen walking back home. The investigators who were searching would be assisted by police officers from neighbouring counties, and then the FBI would be called in. The searchers had the help of volunteers in the community. They were also assisted by horses, dogs, police divers, and helicopters, who scoured overhead to try and catch a glimpse of the missing girl. Sergeant Dan Mahalis stated, "She is an endangered missing child. We do suspect foul play. We believe it is foul play because she did not come home." The area where Summer had vanished was a residential area, but there was woodland nearby as well as retention ponds. There were plenty of places where a child could hide or could accidentally hurt themselves. Investigators requested the assistance of the Navy, who took part in searching the vast woodland for Summer, or anything which could indicate what had happened to her or where she had gone. The community came together to help in the search for Summer. They printed out missing person posters which described Summer as Caucasian, standing at around 3 feet 5 inches tall and weighing around 65 pounds. She also had brown hair which framed her cherubic face. When Summer left her home for school that morning, she had tied her hair in a ponytail with a red bow, and she was carrying a purple Hannah Montana backpack and lunchbox. As for identifying features, she had a birthmark on her lower right leg. These missing person flyers were handed out to passersby and attached to trees and lampposts, urging anybody who knew anything about Summer's disappearance to call police immediately. Alongside many of these flyers, well-wishers had tied a purple ribbon. Purple was Summer's favourite colour, and the ribbon symbolised hope. Hope that Summer would be back home where she belonged soon. As one local woman, Sandra Passo, said to the Florida Times Union, "I just had to do something. I may not have kids of my own, but that doesn't matter. This just shouldn't happen." In addition to physically assisting in the search, community members dedicated their time in other ways. A local Chick-fil-A became a place for volunteers to coordinate their searches, while another Chick-fil-A delivered hundreds of sandwiches to the searchers. As Craig Phillips, the owner of one of the branches, said, "I may not be out searching in the woods, but I can still help." When the call came, the community essentially halted their lives, taking time off work to help search for Summer. While some of them knew the family, the majority didn't, but they were drawn to the case. In a way, Summer had become the entire community's little girl, and they would move heaven and earth to get her back home where she belonged, and where her family were waiting for her. A candlelight vigil was held that night, a symbol that Summer would return home safe and well. A little memorial had begun to grow in the shade of an oak tree across the road from the family's home. Summer's brother Sam carefully rearranged all of the flowers and candles, and commented, "Summer is going to be so happy when she sees this, if we ever get her back." Summer's mother, Dina, made tearful pleas on national television for her daughter's safe return. She really struggled to hold her composure as she said, "Summer, You're not in trouble. If you're scared, just come home. And if somebody has her, please, please bring her back to us. She belongs with her family. Dina struggled when she thought back to the morning she last saw her daughter, telling the Florida Times Union, "I can't even remember if I told her I loved her. I just went to work and told her to have a good day." Summer's father would also be interviewed from his home. During the interview, he appealed to Summer himself, stating, "Summer, your daddy Sam loves you unconditionally. Stay strong and don't give up the fight of the hope that we are going to be a family again. I love you." Sam then said that if his daughter had been kidnapped, he would forgive the kidnapper as long as Summer was allowed to come home. Dina and Sam were experiencing every parent's worst nightmare, and the not knowing must have been unimaginable. While investigators had not said that Summer was abducted, it was looking more and more likely, and Dina said that she too feared the worst for her daughter. The relationship between Dina and Sam was still quite raw due to the divorce, and Summer hadn't seen her father in almost 2 years. Sam was confined to a wheelchair because of an injury he had sustained while in Iraq with the US Army, and he said he couldn't come to Florida because of the wheelchair and his lack of finances to fund such a trip. During an interview with Dina, she was asked if Sam would come to Florida to help search, and she quipped, "Not at my house." Sam hit back, suggesting that he wanted to bring his children to North Carolina, where they would be safer. The disappearance of Summer was certainly perplexing. For a child to vanish in such a short distance, and in such a busy area, yet nobody saw a thing, well, it was quite rare. As the hours continued to pass with no new developments, Sheriff Rick Beasler announced to the public that he too was now fearing the worst, that Summer had been abducted. In a bid to generate some much-needed leads, the Justice Coalition and First Coast Crime Stoppers put forward a reward of $30,000. The search for Summer had been very extensive and exhaustive thus far, with over 12,000 missing person flyers having been distributed and almost 1,000 volunteers, whether that be law enforcement, the Navy, or just the concerned community. The following day, investigators began working a new angle, a more ominous angle. Bins from the neighbourhood were being transported by garbage trucks to a landfill in Folkestone, Georgia, near the Florida state line. Detective Bruce Owen suggested that they follow these garbage trucks and then sift through the garbage at the landfill. It had now been 2 days since Summer had disappeared, and things really weren't looking good. Summer had vanished near her home, and it was speculated that if somebody had have done something sinister to her, then they could have been living nearby, saw Summer on her own and took advantage of her, and then they would have need to dispose of the evidence somewhere. It made sense for investigators to turn their attention to landfill. The landfill in Georgia was where garbage trucks from all over Orange Park take their trash. So the task was an extremely daunting one. There were thousands of tons of garbage at the landfill, and what makes the search even more difficult is the potential of contamination. If you don't know, most landfills are organised into cells based on both location and date. But this isn't always the case. Some are literally just a big pile of garbage. Unfortunately, at the Chester Island Road landfill where investigators were now searching, their system was the latter. So as each garbage truck spilled its load, the investigators sifted through them. As they rummaged through the tons of garbage, one of the investigators spotted what appeared to be human legs protruding out from underneath some garbage. They had already sifted through around 100 tons of garbage when they had removed enough to spot the legs. It was evident that the legs belonged to a child. As investigators removed more garbage, they were met by a horrific scene that none of them would ever forget. Among the tons of garbage was the lifeless body of a little child. Sheriff Rick Beasler informed the media of the tragic find. He said that while they could determine the body was a child, they could not yet determine whether it was a little boy or a little girl, or more importantly, whether it was Summer. The body was transported to the medical examiner's office for an identification to be made and a cause of death to be determined. Before informing the public of the grim discovery, Sheriff Beasler first of all made contact with Summer's family. He later commented that it was the hardest phone call he had ever made in his entire career, and that he hoped he would never have to make another like it. The family were all still clinging to the hope that the body wasn't Summer, with her aunt, Laura Holt, stating in the media that her brother Sam completely fell apart when he learned that a body had been found. While the body had not yet been identified, most people within the area already assumed that it was Summer. After all, she was the only child in the area that was missing. Around 150 members of the community gathered outside Summer's home and began to assemble a makeshift shrine, which consisted of flowers, teddy bears, trinkets, and cards of condolences. Dina came outside and thanked the congregation of people. She asked if they could sing Summer's favourite song, "You Are My Sunshine," to which they aptly obliged. They also sang "Jesus Loves Me" and "This Little Light of Mine," before Dina, so overcome with emotion, collapsed to the ground. Later that day, Sheriff Beasler said that a tentative identification had been made, and they believed that the body in the landfill was Summer. This was based on the clothing found, as well as a birthmark which matched Summer's. He said, "I fear for our community until we bring this person in. This is a heinous crime that's being committed, and we're going to work as hard as we can to make this community safe." The missing person investigation now transformed into a murder investigation. The community were on tenterhooks, knowing that a sadistic child killer was lurking amongst them. Governor Charlie Crist said during a briefing on the developments, "Now we're looking for a suspect. Somebody did it. Now we've got to find out who." The body would then be positively identified as Summer. It was determined that Summer's cause of death was asphyxia with multiple blunt force trauma. While the cause of death had been determined, Sheriff Beasler announced that they would not be publicly disclosing the cause of death just yet, to save the integrity of the investigation. This can be a common tactic in murder investigations, where investigators only want themselves and the killer to know certain facts of the case. The discovery was somewhat bittersweet. At least now Summer's family knew what happened to her, and if investigators hadn't decided on searching the landfill when they did, then in just a couple of days, tons more garbage would have been distributed over the top of Summer's body, making it very unlikely that she ever would have been found. Dina would speak with First Coast News and share her belief that Summer's killer was lying in wait for her. She had a warning for the killer, stating, "Watch out, we're coming for you. We're gonna get you. You took her away from my family. You don't do this to a little baby, and put my baby in the trash." That night, an impromptu candlelight vigil was held outside the family's home. As the hours passed, the shrine had been getting larger and larger, with members of the community leaving flowers and other personal effects to try and help ease the pain the family were feeling. Nearby, somebody had left a box of tissues for those who needed them. The community really wanted to do something for Summer's family, so a bank account was set up in the name of Summer. The purpose was for people to send in donations that would help pay for Summer's upcoming funeral and her burial. However, there were a plethora of local funeral homes that offered up their services for free. Money was the last thing that Dina needed to be thinking of. A handful of fundraisers were held as well to raise some funds. There was one at Orange Park Town Hall which raised more than $20,000 for the family, and over $1,000 for the reward fund, which had grown to $32,500 by now. The money ensured that Dina didn't need to immediately return to work. She could take time off to mourn her daughter and assist in the investigation. The homicide investigation was now in full swing, and investigators turned their attention to a vacant home, around 500 yards away from where Summer was last seen, as she walked home alone after disbanding from her friends and siblings. Neighbours looked on as investigators entered the vacant home while wearing protective white suits. They could be seen searching the home as well as combing through a construction trash bin that sat out the front. Construction crews had been working on the vacant home, which had been damaged several months beforehand in a fire. This was the last place that Summer was seen, and investigators conducted a thorough examination of the vacant home and left with a number of evidence bags. As the evidence was being analysed, investigators appealed to the public. They asked anybody who may have seen Summer as she walked home to get in contact. She was last seen near the vacant home, and she would have had to walk past it. But from here, investigators had not received any more positive sightings of the schoolgirl. The vacant home was on a very populated street, one which a child should have been safe walking down. Over 1,000 tips had been reported to investigators, and each one was being thoroughly investigated. Members of the community reported suspicious-looking people and unknown cars in their neighbourhood. It was hoped that one of these leads could provide a crack in the case, but as they sifted through the tips, it became apparent that no suspect had emerged, at least not yet. On the 27th of October, Summer was laid to rest. A viewing was scheduled for the night before the service, but it was a closed casket viewing. Summer's killer's depravity had robbed her mother of giving her a proper goodbye, seeing her face one last time, or caressing her cheek. Dina had been handed a lock of her daughter's hair to keep as a memento, but the condition of Summer's body would have been too traumatic for a mother to see. And that would have been the last memory that Dina had of her daughter. Hundreds of people lined the street outside the First Baptist Church of Orange Park. When they entered, their eyes focused on Summer's brown wooden casket, which was situated at the front of the church. It was surrounded by floral bouquets that were mostly purple, Summer's favourite colour, and accentuated by red, white and pink flowers. Nearby there was a poster of Summer's face. From here, many locals walked the short distance to Summer's home, where they brought along more offerings for the memorial underneath the oak tree. The next morning, an early morning mist settled in the air as thousands of people filed into the First Baptist Worship Centre. The outpouring of support had been so great that the church was filled to the brim, as was the overspill area. Summer's casket sat at the front of the church, and as the community entered, the song, "You're My Sunshine," emanated quietly from the speakers. Dina and Samuel sat at the front of the church, across the aisle from one another. They dabbed their eyes with tissues as scenes from Summer's life were projected onto two large screens. The service was led by Pastor David Tarkington, who said to the crowd, "Summer was able to love greatly. She was also loved greatly." A lot of those in attendance showed symbols of love, whether it be by wearing purple or holding a sign of condolences. Cindy and George Anthony, the grandparents of Kaylee Anthony, whose mother Casey Anthony was acquitted of her murder, came to the funeral to pay their respects. Following the service, the mourners shuffled out of the church to be met with sunshine. Some commented that it was Summer's son. Purple balloons were released into the air in memory of Summer, following which a private service was held for the loved ones of Summer. They then attended a private burial at Jacksonville Memory Gardens in Orange Park. After laying her precious daughter to rest, Dina wrote a letter to thank the community for their embrace. It read in part, "I have no words to describe the level of support that my family and I have received from people I do not know, from friends and neighbours, from local military personnel and their commands, from local businesses, from local churches, from advocate groups, and from law enforcement personnel, from the local to the national level. To all of you, I say again, thank you. My extended family, many of whom reside in different states, were provided assistance in getting here to support me, and this community embraced them with free lodging. I know personally of three hotels that provided free rooms for my immediate family, as well as discounts for friends attending the services for Summer. I have no idea where all of that food came from to feed my family and I, as well as those who were involved in the search. I thank you for all you did." The search for Summer's killer was ramped up in the wake of the funeral. As Sheriff Beasler said, "Yesterday was about Summer Thompson. Today is about her killer." He addressed the public and once again pleaded for any information, but said he was directing his message at specific individuals. He said he believed that there were people in the community who had information pertinent to the investigation, who had not yet come forward, either because they felt their information was not important or relevant, or because they were too scared. He asked these people to think back to the day Summer disappeared and the days that followed. For example, was somebody acting different than normal? Had somebody left the area? Or had somebody deviated from their normal routine? The call to action led to growing numbers of phone calls and email tips, all of which were going to be analysed by investigators. A segment on the unsolved murder was also featured on America's Most Wanted, leading to a plethora of tips. John Walsh, who was the host of the show and the father of Adam Walsh, shared his own theories on Good Morning America. He suggested that the killer of Summer had struck before. In fact, he suggested that the murder was linked to the disappearances of four children in the Jacksonville area, which happened 20 years earlier. He stated, "I would hate to think that this is a serial child killer who has raised its ugly head." The suggestion struck fear into the heart of parents throughout Jacksonville and the surrounding area. Could a child killer have come out of retirement? And if so, were they going to strike again? Based on the fact that Summer's body was found at landfill, it was theorized that her killer was local. He obviously disposed of her body in a garbage can that was then transported to the landfill where she was found. This also led to much speculation that the killer may not have access to transport. The tips continued to flood the police department, and by November, almost 3,000 had been logged. They were now just waiting for that one lucrative tip, which could crack the case wide open. But as of yet, none of the tips had materialized. That same month, investigators released sketches of items that were not found with Summer's body. Her clothing was found, but Summer had also been carrying a zippered lunchbox with a pink pig design and a book tote which featured skulls, stars, and hearts. The reward fund was increased to $64,000, a fine incentive for anybody who may be harboring information. Meanwhile, Dina granted an interview to the Florida Times Union to share the wave of grief and uncertainty that she felt each day. She said to the reporter that she struggled every single day, especially when she was alone with her thoughts. She referred to Summer's killer as it, and said that she still talks to Summer, even though she is not physically there. Dina commented, "I wish I could just smell her, see her, or touch her. I tell her every day that I love her, how much I miss her, and how sorry I am that somebody did this." Sam and Abby had since returned to school, but each morning and afternoon Dina drove them. She commented to the Florida Times Union, "I'm always second-guessing myself as far as them walking home, but I did what I could as a single mother with absolutely no help from anybody. Children should be able to walk home without being afraid of being attacked by a monster." She now refused to let them walk the same route that Summer did, the same walk where Summer was intercepted by her killer. Sam and Abby were undergoing counselling to try and help them cope with their anguish. Sam in particular had struggled with the loss of his twin, but he cried himself to sleep almost every night. Investigators were keeping very tight-lipped on the investigation. As mentioned, they hadn't publicly released Summer's cause of death. The absence of cold hard facts in the case gave way to rumour and speculation. Bruce Herring, the director of the Institute of Police Technology and Management, said that rumours, often magnified by bloggers, were stealing valuable time that could be spent in the field. Investigators really need to examine each tip and lead, but a lot of them coming in were based on rumours that were exacerbated online. ...24-year-old Jared Harrell was born in Lucedale, Mississippi, to parents Howard and Annis. The couple had been married in October 1979, and 7 months later their daughter was born, followed by Harrell in 1985. Just a year after Harrell's birth, Annis and Harrell divorced, with Annis being granted full custody of the children. 3 years later, Howard got them back for quite a bizarre reason. When Annis and Howard were together, Annis had been having an affair with Joe Newman, who she had been working as a secretary for. Joe was an eccentric local inventor, and he was already married. While Joe's wife and Harold had no idea about the affair at the time, in February of 1989, Joe had publicised a 17-page news release in which he announced that he was not only married to his wife, but he was also married to Annis and Annis's daughter, who was only 8 years old at the time. In this so-called news release, Joe said that he was a prophet of God. The news release had made its way to Howard, who contacted state child welfare officials. In September of 1989, Annis and Joe married. And Joe explained during a court hearing that his marriage to her 8-year-old daughter was simply spiritual, not sexual. A judge ultimately removed Harold and his sister from their mother and Joe's care. Eventually, Annis came to her senses, and she was determined to get her children back. The judge referred to her attempts as manipulative and refused. It wasn't until 1993 that Annis got her children back. Once back with their mother, she married again for a third time. Her husband this time was Richard Wharton. The marriage was officiated when Harold was 5 years old. The family settled down in Lucedale, southern Mississippi, where Annis continued to homeschool her son. When Howard lost custody of the children, he wasn't really that interested in seeing them any further. He seemingly felt that he had done all that he could as a father, and he was ready to move on with his life. He didn't see them for 8 years, only seeing them in court in 2003 when he sought to stop paying child support. Growing up, Harold was a quiet, church-going teenager, but he found himself in hot water when he was caught stealing at just 13 years old. The marriage between Annis and Richard broke down. A couple of years later, Annis found love once more with a man from Florida, and she and Harold moved into his brick ranch-style home at 1152 Gano Avenue, Orange Park. As an adult, Harold held down a number of menial jobs, but never for a prolonged period. He preferred to spend his time alone in his bedroom playing video games. Some former employers had to let him go for what they described as a quick temper. For the past 6 years, Harold had no contact with his father, Howard, who had since remarried. In mid-2009, Harold moved in with Matt McWhorter and his fiancée, who was the stepdaughter of Rob Buchanan, a family friend of the Harolds. In August of that same year, Harold was on the move once more. His roommates had kicked him out of the apartment where they were living in Orange Park after he stole an MP3 player from them. Harold left the apartment in a hurry, leaving behind his computer. Harold's roommates had always found him quite peculiar, and in fact, they had feared that he may have been a paedophile. Curiosity got the better of them, and they decided to look on his computer. What they found would completely traumatize them. On Harold's computer, he had multiple items of child abuse images and videos. The children in the images and videos were between the ages of 6 and 13. This wasn't the first time that Harold had been caught with disturbing and illegal content. 8 years earlier, Harold's stepfather, Richard, had become interested about what Harold had kept in a locked tackle box in his bedroom closet. One day he removed the hinges and lifted out several discs. He loaded one of them onto the computer and found child sex abuse images of young girls, some of whom were no older than 5 or 6. Richard asked Annis if she thought her son had a pornography addiction, but he did not inform her of what exactly he had found. She said no. Richard simply put the discs back into the box and never spoke of it again. When the roommates discovered the child sex abuse images and videos in August of 2009, they contacted the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, who in turn handed the material over to state investigators. As this case was under investigation, Summer vanished, and then 3 days later, her body was found. That same week, Ron was driving past the Harold's family home. He commented to his wife how close it was to where Summer had vanished. Harold's mother had recently moved out of the home, but Ron noticed that Harold's car was in the driveway. Ron commented, "I got goosebumps." He thought back to the ominous discovery on Harold's computer. He drove down to the police headquarters and told them about Harold and the child abuse images and videos that had been found on his computer. It seemed like too much of a coincidence. Even more suspicious, after Summer's body was found, Harold had picked up and moved back to Meridian in Mississippi, where he lived with his aunt, Chris Mizell. It wasn't until February of 2010 that Harold was finally arrested in relation to the child abuse images and videos. He was ordered to be held on $1 million bond. Investigators additionally announced that Harold was now being looked at as a person of interest in the murder of Summer. Once Harald was identified in the media, those who knew him said that in the aftermath of Sommer's disappearance, he began to act different. He lost a lot of weight, became reclusive, and grew facial hair. It was almost like he was trying to conceal his identity and stay out of the public eye, instead opting to spend his time indoors almost every hour of the day. As details of Harald emerged in the media, the police were met with much criticism. Harald had been put forward as a potential suspect just days after Sommer was found dead. And only adding to those suspicions, child abuse images and videos were found on his computer before she vanished. And yet he remained a free man. Harald had been put forward as a potential suspect just days after Sommer was found dead. And even more poignant, child sex abuse images and videos were found on his computer before she vanished. But yet he remained a free man. A statement was released from Sheriff Beasler, who said that such investigations take time and require a painstaking process to link the images back to the suspect. While Harald's computer certainly did have incriminating images and videos, it wasn't until the 25th of September that the computer was given to the State Attorney General's Child Predator Cybercrime Unit. Once here, the state needed to wait for a warrant. It wasn't until October that the state began a forensic examination of the computer, but this was 10 days before Sommer disappeared. The results of the forensic examination came back on the 12th of November. With Harald behind bars, a police presence was noted at 1152 Gano Avenue, where Harald had lived with his mother, and more recently, lived there alone. Investigators shut off access to at least a block surrounding the home as they searched both inside and outside. The home where Harald had been living with his aunt Chris was also searched by investigators. Chris had come home to find the FBI there. She was quick to come to her nephew's defence, commenting to the Meridian Star, "He isn't the monster they say he is. He came here to visit, maybe find a job. He liked it here, and in no way did he act or say anything that would make me think he'd done anything wrong, especially child porn or murder." Harald needed to be extradited back to Florida, where the investigation into his potential involvement in Sommer's murder could begin. But Harald fought the extradition. He demanded the investigators show the probable cause for him to be charged with child pornography. Due to his lack of cooperation, investigators travelled to a ranch-style home deep in the Mississippi woods. It was where Harald's father, Howard, lived with his new wife. Investigators requested a DNA sample from him, and Howard complied, opening his mouth to be swabbed. Harald's attempt to not be extradited failed, and Florida Governor Charlie Crist got involved, requesting Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour to extradite him. She signed the extradition order, and Harald was back in Florida before the end of the month. When he arrived, he was hit with more charges, including child molestation and a dozen counts of child pornography. These charges did not relate to Sommer, but instead another little girl. Harald was accused of molestation and graphic videotaping and photographing of a three-year-old girl in the home owned by Harald's stepfather on Gano Avenue. These incidents occurred between May and November of 2008. These videos and photographs were found in Annis's home. The little girl was identified as somebody in the family, and family members had also identified the bedroom as Harald's bedroom. Harald pleaded not guilty to 55 counts of child pornography, including 2 counts of molesting the girl. With the charges handed down, Harald was questioned about his potential involvement in Sommer's murder. He told investigators that he was at his mother and stepfather's home in Orange Park between the hours of 3 p.m. and 5:30 p.m. on the day that Sommer vanished. He said that they had spent this time packing up for her to move. When investigators spoke with Annis, she said that she was with her son at the home, but only for around an hour, following which they left, had dinner together, and then split up at around 5:30. What Harald and Annis weren't aware of, however, was that a phone call between them had been recorded at the jail, wherein Annis had told her son that she would provide him with an alibi in Sommer's murder. The following week, Harald was finally charged with the sexual assault and murder of Sommer. He was facing charges of premeditated murder and battery and sexual battery. Investigators have been working around the clock tirelessly, and they had a theory as to what had happened. After Summer had disbanded from her close circle, she was spotted by Harold, who was alone at his mother and stepfather's old home on Gano Avenue. It was at this home that Summer sometimes stopped to pet a white dog that was often in the yard. Most days, nobody came out. This day, however, Harold came out. The dog wasn't there because he had been taken to the new home 2 days earlier. Summer stopped outside and glanced into the yard, hoping to catch a glimpse of the white dog. She had just had her feelings hurt by the spat, and she knew that getting to pet the big white dog would make it all better. Harold spotted the little girl and came out. What he said to lure her into the home remains a mystery. Maybe he told her the dog was inside, and that she could come inside to pet him. Once Summer was out of view from prying eyes on the neighbourhood, Harold removed her clothing, fondled her, and then attempted to rape her. At some point, he beat Summer, and then strangled her to death. After killing her, he placed her in some kind of container and then took her body to the dumpster. The revelation completely tore Summer's loved ones up. Dina spoke during a press conference.
158 days ago, my 7-year-old twin daughter was walking home from school, like a child should be allowed to do. And on this day, someone took her away from me, her siblings, my family, and the world. A monster. That's all this person is a monster. Summer was such a bright star that never got her chance to shine. You know, justice is not fast as an impulse. And that's what this monster did. He had an impulse, and he took something away from me that no one will ever be able to give back to me. I never liked Mondays, but as far as I'm concerned, there will be no Mondays in my life, because that's the day my life ended. And I stood here in front of all of you 150 something days ago and said that we're coming to get you. We will get you. And so I'd like to take this opportunity to say to Jared Harrell, we got you and you ain't getting away.
She said that she would be supporting the prosecution's efforts to seek the death penalty against Harrell if he were convicted of the murder. The charges had brought some much-needed relief for the family, but there was still a long way to go. The prospect of a murder trial was certainly a daunting one, where the family knew that they would have to relive Summer's last moments on Earth, as she was sexually assaulted and then strangled. It wasn't much of a surprise to the community when the prosecution announced the following month that they were going to be seeking the death penalty against Harold. It was the ultimate penalty for a man charged with such a heinous crime against an innocent child. Harold pleaded not guilty to the sexual assault and murder of Summer shortly thereafter. The prospect of a death sentence seemingly terrified Harold, because in February of 2012 he agreed to plead guilty to the murder of Summer in exchange for a life sentence. Summer's family all gathered in the courtroom to hear the details of the plea agreement. Most of them wore purple in honour of Summer. Harold pleaded guilty to first-degree murder, kidnapping, sexual battery, possession of child pornography, and other sex charges relating to the 3-year-old relative. The prosecution had built a strong case against Harold and had linked him to the murder with DNA evidence that was found on Summer's body. After Harold had been presented with this evidence, he made a full confession, but not before claiming he had blacked out memories from that day. He claimed that Summer had shown up at the home on Gano Avenue and asked if she could see his dog. He said that she got nervous and began to scream, so he smothered her by holding one hand over her mouth and the other behind her head.
I was moving things from my bedroom to the garage. I was in my room, I filled a bag up full of clothes, and on my way back out to the garage, I noticed Summer in the doorway. I kind of started to approach her a little bit, and I said, "What are you doing in here?" At that point, she started getting anxious, I guess. She looked like she was just scared to death.
Right.
And she started screaming.
Did you try to make her be quiet because you didn't want anybody to hear her screaming? And how did you, you said you put your hand over her mouth?
Correct.
What happened from there?
She kind of went limp. Through all the panic and everything, I noticed that, you know, she wasn't moving.
Right.
At that point, I realized that she was probably dead. And I got one of the red Rubbermaid boxes. I put her in it.
Harl said that he had tried to sexually assault Summer after she was dead. He admitted he removed clothing from her lifeless body, commenting to the investigator, "Honestly, I don't remember this until now." After killing Summer, he stuffed her body in a container and then put it in a commercial dumpster behind Beauty and the Beef, a local restaurant.
I drove to Fleming Island behind Beauty and the Beef, and I put the box in the dumpster. At that point, I'd already started kind of closing myself off to it. I was just spending time with my mom. As bad as it sounds, it wasn't in my head, you know, I was just trying to
block it out. Yeah.
While Harl admitted his involvement, he stopped short of admitting that the murder was purposefully carried out, instead opting to claim it was a spur of the moment thing, brought on when Summer began to randomly scream. Before ending the interview, Harl asked the investigator if he could pass on a message to Dina. He said, "Can you just tell her that I'm really sorry? It's not a regretful thing, it's a remorseful thing. I really am sorry that it happened. I know I'm going through some rough times, but I can't imagine what she's going through. I never had a kid, so I don't know what that kind of bond is like." Before Harl was formally sentenced to life in prison, Summer's family addressed him. Summer's grandfather, Philip, read a very poignant statement.
"Allow me to introduce myself. My name is Philip Bowley. I'm a retired federal agent. I'm Dina Thompson's father. But most importantly, I'm Summer Thompson's papa. I'm used to being able to make sense of and handle any problem. You presented me with the first problem I have not been able to fix. Let me start by talking about justice. There is no justice for a life taken too soon. You can't give a life back once it's been taken. There is justice for you, the perpetrator, but not for the victim. In this case, justice is about making sure that you can never hurt another child."
Summer's twin brother, Sam, had a few words he wanted to say. Sam was 9 years old now, 2 years older than his twin sister ever got to be. He walked up to the witness stand as Dina, who was standing beside him, told Harl who he was.
"This is Summer's twin, by the way, Jared. You should look up here and address us since you murdered her."
Sam stared directly at Harl and addressed him.
"We know you did this. We have evidence. She trusted you. But you had to do what you did. And look where it got you. And now you're going to jail."
Abigail, who was now 12 years old, struggled to contain her emotion as she addressed the man who killed her little sister.
"I don't even know how you can live with yourself. You don't even know how bad you've hurt my family. But I hope you have to suffer just like me and my family did. I can't even explain how much me, my friends, my family, everybody I know and everybody my family knows how much they hate you. You're not even a human being. Your name is not Jared Harrell. Your name is Monster. Yeah, honestly, I can't even stand to say your name. I can't even call you a human being. Summer Thompson, the adorable, loving, caring little girl you murdered. I'm pretty sure he hates you too. The little girl was the community's everything. My family's everything. And most importantly, my everything. I still don't understand how you can do this to my family. For a matter of fact, anybody. I hope you never get out of jail. Of course you won't, because you're a child murderer. You know what they say, once a cheater, always a cheater. Well, in this case, once a murderer, always a murderer. Why would you murder a child and mess up your life? I don't even understand how you could have. I don't understand how you could have had a good life. But no, you ruined it. All of it. No going back now.
Dina was next.
Well, once again, I think that you should look at me, the mother of the child that you strangled and raped and threw in the trash. But cowardly as always, you can keep your head buried.
While Dina had wanted Harold to be sentenced to death, she put her children first, knowing that the ordeal of a trial would have traumatized them. They would most likely have to testify about the day that Summer disappeared. She ordered Harold to look at her and sneered when he refused.
835 days ago, you lured my baby into your lair with trickery and malice in your soul, all to commit unspeakable acts of your own selfish desires and flat-out evilness. Summer was an innocent child. Before you took her life, you took her dignity, her virginity, and then you took her life. After all that, you then treated my child like trash.
She continued and told Harold that the punishment did not fit the crime, and said that there was no safe place for Harold, that he did not have an impenetrable cell, and that in his afterlife, there would be no peace. Jared Harrell was sentenced to 6 life sentences and more than 35 years for the separate child pornography charges. In handing down the sentence, Judge Don Lester referred to Harrell's crimes as inconceivable. In the aftermath of Summer's murder, her family established the Summer Thompson Foundation. The purpose of the non-profit was to help families of abduction victims, the result in death. April 5th was also proclaimed Summer Thompson Day in honour of Summer by the Clay County Commission. April 5th was Summer's birthday. The house where Summer lost her life became the target of vandalism. It stood as a tragic reminder of what Summer endured behind the forest green front door, and local children were absolutely terrified to walk behind it, although they knew that the man who had hurt Summer was not going to hurt them. In 2015, it was decided that the home was going to be burned to the ground as a training exercise by the Orange Park Fire Department. The home had been taken over by the Summer Thompson Foundation. Dina said the idea of someone raising a family there was painful for her, and this was the best way to move forward. As Dina said, "My children should never have to witness walking past that house. And other people shouldn't have to stare at trash all day." On Valentine's Day of 2015, the home was set alight. As the fires engulfed the home, Summer's family watched on. It was a cathartic end to the nightmare that had plagued Dina and the family for so long. From the embers of the House of Horrors, a living memorial teeming with literal and figurative nourishment was built. The Summer Thompson Foundation partnered with Bring Food Forests to Northeast Florida, a grassroots group dedicated to bringing food forests to public areas, as well as supporting local homeschooling students. The home where Summer lost her life was now gone, and in its place, a self-sustaining, organic food forest blossomed with life. It was aptly named Summer's Garden, and it stood as a poignant reminder that even in times of unimaginable tragedy, something positive can flourish. The murder of Summer Thompson completely shattered the sense of security in Orange Park, where children once played freely on the street and walked to and from school without fear of being snatched. As the search for Summer's killer intensified, the community all began to look at one another through suspicious eyes. The wheels of justice can often move slowly, and this tragic case bore as a chilling reminder. if Jared Harrell's pedophilic nature had have been treated with more importance, then maybe, just maybe, Summer would still be alive today. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, a massive thank you for listening. And I'd also like to say a huge thank you to my lovely new Patreon supporters, Jodie, Kate, Steve, Erica Lynn, and Stephanie. The support on Patreon seriously goes such a long way. Morbidology is a one-woman podcast. I research, write, and produce the episodes myself. And I am eternally grateful for all of your support, both by listening and by joining me on Patreon. If you'd like to support the show on Patreon, the link is in the show notes. In exchange for your support, you get ad-free and early release episodes, bonus episodes that aren't on the regular podcast platforms, behind the scenes, which includes bonus audio, videos, and case files, and I also send out a thank you card and some cool merch. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And please stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing podcast, True Consequences, hosted by my friend, Eric. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Hello, this is Eric Carter Lundeen, the host and producer of True Consequences, a true crime and mystery podcast with stories based in New Mexico and the American Desert Southwest. We'll uncover cases such as the Toy Box Killer, one of the worst serial rapists and suspected serial killers in New Mexico's history. We will also discuss mysteries such as alien sightings, as well as hauntings and other weird things that happen in this area of the country. I hope you'll give me a chance and listen to True Consequences. I think you might enjoy it.
You can find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.